This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A good script is one of the most essential ingredients for a good movie or TV show, yet we seldom hear about the industry from a writer's point of view. Every couple of years, the Writers Guild Foundation holds a conference called Words into Pictures, in which writers are joined by producers, studio executives, and marketers to discuss the issues facing the industry. Words into Pictures 2002 was held last month in Los Angeles. We're going to hear an excerpt of the panel called The Writer as Subversive. Its purpose was to address the question, in a business driven by bottom lines and global conglomerates, how can writers do personally important work that serves their conscience and pays the mortgage at the same time? The panelists we'll hear are David Milch, the co-creator and former executive producer of NYPD Blue. He also wrote for Hill Street Blues. Stephen Gagan, the screenwriter of Traffic, who used to write for NYPD Blue, and Aaron Sorkin, creator and executive producer of The West Wing. He also created Sports Night and wrote the play and screenplay A Few Good Men. The panel was moderated by Tavis Smiley, the host of the new NPR program The Tavis Smiley Show. The discussion begins with the question, has it gotten easier or more difficult for a writer with integrity to do good work in Hollywood? We hear first from Stephen Gagan.
I'd worked in television. I knew I wanted to write about the military. I was interested in the military. I saw this thing, you know, we spend a third of every tax dollar on it, and there didn't seem to be any civilian oversight, you know, saying the military is for cleaning up after hurricanes or stopping famine in Somalia or, you know, whatever it is, and I thought that was weird, and I knew I wanted to write about it. I had one job where I wrote about it, and I wrote a script very specifically. It had multiple characters, multiple narrative. I turned it in, and I got screamed at for 2.5 hours, my favorite line was, "War on trial. War is always on trial. You want to make a $60 million movie about the military in Hollywood? You better have a goddamn protagonist, and that goddamn protagonist better win. And there's an antagonist, and when he goes down in the third act, the people come out of their chairs and they cheer. If you don't have that, you don't have a f-ing movie."
Did they actually talk that way in Hollywood?
Just like that.
Just like
and,
that.
I mean, my hair was blowing back. I looked like the guy in that, you know, tape commercial. I was like, and I was anxious not to be fired. You know, the whole time I was getting yelled at. In my head, I'm going, I quit. And then I thought about it, and I was like, as a political animal, the job was important to me. And I went away, and in 3 weeks, I rewrote the movie with, you know, the whole time he was talking, I was like, antagonist, you know, what is this antagonist? I'd never thought about it that way. I was like, that sounds really smart. Wow. And,
better all the time.
What a good idea. So I went away after that moment, and I rewrote the thing in 3 weeks. I turned it in, and it turned out people were happy, and the movie got made. Okay, now, cut to my next job that I'd actually been procrastinating on, which was writing Traffic, when I took this job. And I'd been terrified to write it. It was very personal to me. I had a tremendous amount of indignation over this thing called the war on drugs, and I was very angry about it, and I had a hard time starting, and it was driving me crazy. Finally, I got the break. I got in, I got the entry point, and it just flew, and I had this 165-page script that had no major characters. It had 35 main characters. It had 5 stories. It was, you know, filled with things you could never make in Hollywood. A drug movie, black drug dealers raping white girls and injecting them with heroin, and, you know, the pride of the upper middle class being seduced into this world. I turned it into Steven Soderbergh, and I dropped it on his porch, and I didn't hear from him for a couple days. I got anxious. I called him up, and he's a very soft-spoken person. And he goes, "Hello?" I said, "Hey, Steven, it's Steve Gagan." He goes, "Oh, hey." "Did you get the script?" Yeah, I got it." "Did you read it?" Yeah, I read it." "What'd you think of it?" I liked it, it's good." I mean, there's like a 30-second silence now. I don't know what to say, and he says, "No, I'm going to do it. I'm going to make it as my next movie." And at that point, it began a process that was totally different than any process I'd ever been in Hollywood and before or after, which was he was able, due to the success of his career at that point, to really build a wall And we had no studio, and nobody put any notes in. It was just literally the two of us pleasing ourselves. And the movie, we finally had a studio. We funded pre-production out of our own pockets, and we had a studio 3 weeks before we started shooting. In this instance, it felt like the easiest thing in the world. It was like falling downhill. All the ideas he had made the script better. I mean, and one of the first ideas was, we can't get a movie star because there's nobody that has a big enough role. And that made perfect sense to me. And so I rewrote the entire role for Michael Douglas. That's just pragmatics, but whether it's easier in the past or easier now, I don't know. This feels like a peculiar experience, but yet the fact that that type of peculiar experience can happen, and it only happened 2 years ago, this is not the distant past, I think it's very encouraging.
David, I'll come to you first since you raised this. It is a business, and a business that is changing dramatically. Multinational companies, conglomerates, vertical integration. Seems to me, I know in what I do, that makes everything much more difficult. But I'm not in the business that you all are in. Talk to me about how the way this industry is changing, given the things I just mentioned, how that impacts a writer, whether or not that makes it more difficult or easy to do what writers do.
It makes it a lot more difficult. I'll tell you that I left NYPD Blue a couple years ago, and I was deciding where I was going to work next. And I had a couple of negatives. I met with some people. I said, well, this guy I will not work for, and this network I will not work for. I made my arrangements, and within 2 weeks, I was working for that guy at that network. Because, you know, they keep swallowing each other up so fast. And it's important to understand that at its heart, this is a business which whose predicate is most essentially antagonistic to creativity. What they want is something predictable. Having said that, it's possible to do something which looks predictable, which is in fact creative. And the so that Steve is because of a concatenation of circumstances is able to do something which a little while ago people said it's impossible. You don't have an antagonist, you don't have a sympathetic figure, but because now they are able to, well, there's Steve Soderbergh. We don't know what he does, but he's bringing it in. He's bringing it in. Maybe Steve, when the black guy gets the white girl, is he a light-skinned black guy? Can we at least do that? Hey, I give to the parties. I give to the Democratic Party, but if we could have a light-skinned, a high yellow guy, how about that? You know, and you just, okay.
That's David Milch. We'll hear more of the Writers Guild Foundation panel discussion, The Writer as Subversive, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the panel discussion, The Writer as Subversive, recorded in June at the Writers Guild Foundation's conference, Words into Pictures. The panelists we're hearing from are David Milch, co-creator of NYPD Blue, Stephen Gagan, screenwriter of Traffic and former writer for NYPD Blue, and Aaron Sorkin, creator of The West Wing. The moderator is Tavis Smiley, host of NPR's new program, The Tavis Smiley Show. They've been discussing the creative process behind scripts that turned out to be controversial. Here Gagan is talking about working with Milch on NYPD Blue.
When we shared the Emmy, I'd worked on a script for him out of a story that he'd come up with. I wrote, and it had come out a certain way, and it wasn't very good. And David took it, and I got to sit next to him in this little room, and I watched him do this thing. It was an episode of NYPD Blue where Sipowicz had to confront the fact that he was a racist, and it had a pretty famous scene at the end where he's in the locker room with Jimmy Smits, and he's trying to justify his own racism, and he tells this very long story about watching his dad come back from Vietnam, and watching his dad get his eye knocked out with a ball-peen hammer, just trying to read a gas meter in a black neighborhood. I was there when David created that. He didn't know what he was going to write. He was just sitting there. He got in some groove, and he just dictated it. And it came out in a rush. It won the Emmy for us as writers. It won the Emmy for the actor. It won the Emmy for the director. And he was, I mean, you should have seen him. He was running around the Bochco building. He was just like, my God, and because we all knew what had happened. What he'd done, though, was write something very subtle and very beautiful about racism, about racism in America. He didn't set out to say, I'm going to make some statement about racism. I mean, it just happened. I watched it, and yet it was very subtle, and it was beautiful. And everybody, a lot of people in this country, like 30 million Americans at that time, really related to Sipowicz. Sipowicz was a racist, but they also related to him. And here he is trying to justify it in the baldest, ugliest way. You know, it was a beautiful thing, and it didn't seem planned necessarily.
If I may, just to let you know, this is not ours is not a business which demands honor, but it does not absolutely preclude honor. And one of the things that's so exciting about being in it is after I
David, you ought to be an ambassador. You really
thank
good.
You. Know. But what I want to say is, 2 years later, I woke up one morning, and I said, "My God, that story was a lie." Now, when I wrote it, I knew that story was true. And I suddenly realized that the truth was Sipowicz's father was a drunk. He'd been fired for not reading the meters. He came home. He said, "These c***ers, they want me to go read these niggers' meters? I'll go out. I'll read these f***ing niggers' meters at 10 o'clock at night." And he kicked the black man's door down. And the man put a hammer in his eye, protecting his house. Now, I swear to you that I had no idea that when I wrote the first scene that the second scene was true. But I suddenly realized that's how a son protects his image of his father. And the fact that we continue to show up every week and stay available, sometimes we're going to do commerce, but if you keep showing up and you try to stay true to what Henry James called the obstinate finality and artistic sensibility, then sometimes you get lucky.
All right, an hour and 7 minutes in this conversation, the word nigger finally came up, and so...
I apologize.
I'm not ready to have this race question and conversation. If in fact, this business, again, is taking risk, it seems to me that one of the areas where we're not taking risk is on the question of diversity, on the issue of diversity. And I really shouldn't even phrase it that way because it ought not to be a risk. It ought not to be a risk to show on television and on the big screen the breadth and depth of what America really is. It ought not to be a risk, a quantum leap, to have what we see reflect what America is. And yet this industry, quite frankly, sucks and stinks when it comes to valuing diversity. I'm not just talking about color, I'm talking about gender as well. We do a horrible job, it seems to me, in this business. Everybody gives lip service to this, and with all due respect to the guild, even when we have these conversations, save the one Negro in the middle moderating the conversation, all of the diversity panel was yesterday. I mean, was it yesterday? They had a diversity panel yesterday. So apparently all the Negroes were on that panel yesterday, and we can't find one black writer to be on this panel today. Having said that, with all due respect to the guild, what is the problem to this day? We live now, and we've had this debate for years. I'm not blaming the guild for this. This is an age-old question. But it seems to me that we now live in the most multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic America ever. And yet we keep coming back to this ridiculous conversation about why we cannot see, not just in front of the camera, characters that reflect the breadth and depth of diversity in this country, but indeed the writing staffs that you represent stink, quite frankly, in terms of diversity when it comes to people of color and women. What are we going to do about that, and what is the problem here, gentlemen, ladies?
What do you think the problem is?
Yeah. I think the problem is, well, this ain't my panel. You don't want to hear that.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, no,
I do.
You're
the only Negro here.
Yeah, well, that's a good one. In that case, let me represent all the Negroes in America, then, if I might. I think, you know, I am not so sure. It's one of two things, and perhaps a combination of both. It is ignorance or it is arrogance. It seems to me, though, that the ignorance argument starts to, you know, speaking of one foot, flying over the cuckoo's nest, this ignorance argument is flown. I mean, that dog just won't hunt anymore. So let's pass on the ignorance argument, which leaves me with one thing left, David, arrogance. It is the pomposity and the arrogance of the folk who write in this business who don't feel compelled on any level to include people of color in these scripts.
Well,
that's just my take on it, but you guys do this, not me.
Yeah, I disagree.
All right, Aaron.
Well, first of all, you're talking about two different things. You're talking about characters in the script, but you're also talking about behind the
characters,
camera.
Characters, issues, behind the camera, all of the above.
Yeah.
The track record stinks either way, Aaron.
Yeah, I don't think so. In terms of behind the camera for staffing positions, Tavis, we hunt high and low for people of color.
Aaron, before you go there, with all due respect, please don't give me the argument you can't find no qualified people of color. Please don't say that. Please don't say that.
I'm not talking about qualified people of color. I don't believe in tokenism. It's not important to me to fill two of these slots with people of color. I hire the very best people that I can.
Right.
In terms of casting the show, from which we took a certain amount of heat, at the time we couldn't really say which was true, which was that simply for every role, for every single role, including and especially the character of the president,
right,
we read and in fact offered the role to both men and women of color. First person we offered the character of the president to was Sidney Poitier. In the case of Sidney Poitier, he passed. In the case of other situations, you know, we cast the actor who came in and read the best. We're absolutely open to multi-ethnic, multi-racial casting. It was never a question in our mind. We would have been happier to have done it because we wouldn't have, frankly, been confronted with this. But in the end, I have to tell you something. In a panel that's talking about integrity, we truly did stay true to our conscience. We cast the actors that we wanted in the parts. And as a result of having cast 7 of the 8 principal cast as white, we then go out of our way week after week after week after week to make sure that the secretary of this and the chairman of that and the senator from here does represent a cross-section of America.
Let me ask this question, David, before you respond. Let me ask this question, and anybody, feel free to respond to this. Let's assume for the moment that I'm right about this, because I am right about this, that this industry has a long way to go in front of and behind the camera in terms of appreciating diversity. But for the purposes of our conversation today, we're talking about writers. How do we challenge those persons in this room, those on this panel, who are doing the writing? Whether, you know, I'm not asking for token positions, but it seems to me you got to do one of two things. You either got to hire more people of color who can write expressly and uniquely from a colored perspective, so to speak, or you got to challenge the folk who write for the West Wing and everybody else in here who writes to have a more wholesome and a more universal view of the world that we live in. How do we challenge those folks who do the writing, who are not persons of color, to be more fair in their writing?
That's wonderful.
Is that a legitimate question?
Yeah, it's a legitimate question, and I would say a couple of things. The first thing I would do is to address the people of color, because the people who make the decisions are not going to give you a fair shot. So that's the first thing to understand. And the certainty that you have that they're not going to give you a fair shot is all of their good intentions. Because the moment you start talking about good intentions and reaching out and I've tried to make myself available and so, that's somebody who is justifying a preconception about the nature of reality. Any writer comes to you by ones. He doesn't come to you, or she doesn't come to you as a black person or a white person, comes to you as a writer. And my prejudice is to respond to the person with whose lexicon I am most familiar. Now, I cop to this. I taught a seminar. I try to be available as a teacher every year. I try to be, anybody can come to those seminars. So someone asked me a question, well, how can you write a racist character? I said, because I'm a racist. Anybody here who has not had racist feelings, it's the nature of the beast. Freud wrote about the narcissism of perceived difference. It's the way that we function. We see ourselves and we see others. Okay, so that's the most obvious kind of statement. Now, a lot of people in that audience were taping the conversation, and some of them sent it to newspapers. I am a racist, confesses creator of NYPD Blue. Headline in the Washington Post. Now, there was one guy who wrote me a letter, and he said, congratulations on guaranteeing the future employment of so many mediocre white motherfuckers. And I met with him. And he won an Emmy for us, and he just won an Emmy for himself for the series The Corner, and he's doing just fine. Now, the challenge that I would put is to stop thinking to writers of color is it's not a just environment. Part of the bullshit that we use to keep the things the way they are is to pretend that it is just. It's not just, because I don't respond with the same open heart to people who seem to me to be different. That's the way that human beings are. And not only do I not respond the same way, but I will develop a whole mythology to justify the fact that I don't respond the same way until an individual shows me otherwise. And we're going to get there by ones. And what my teacher told me was the secret subject of any story worth telling is time. And it's going to take time. And the only way it's going to happen is not through collective programs. It's going to happen through people not internalizing a sense of grievance, not therefore doing, well, here's commerce and here's conscience, and if I'm going to succeed as a writer of color, I have to subordinate conscience and do commerce. Forget it. Stay with your story and come with your story. And then hope you get lucky, as Mr. Goldman said. Well, just hope you get lucky, because there's no guarantee anybody gets lucky. I spent 20 years in a room, and I was just as good a writer as I am now, and I couldn't get out of my own way, and then I got lucky.
That was an excerpt from the Writer as Subversive panel from the Writers Guild Foundation conference recorded last month in Los Angeles. Thanks to all the panel participants and the foundation for making this broadcast possible. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.